He was a sailor had seen a sailor of love, and he thought he could save her from innocence up and above, because he never knew freedom.
Okay, so I am here with Barry Gifford to talk about the reissue of the Sailor and Lula novels from Seven Stories Press. Barry, how are you doing?
I'm just fine.
That's great. I wanted to start with a general query about the Sailor and Lula series in a nutshell. With the last three novels, the intervals between time shift to those that involve 10-year intervals, which leads me to wonder if this is in some sense a response to Updike's Rabbit Angstrom series, or whether that ever factored into the writing of these latter novels more so.
John Updike never entered into this at all, and he never entered into the novels. The interesting thing to me is that very few people understand the compression of time in the Sailor and Lula novels, because Sailor and Lula age.
Yeah.
They go from, you know, 20 to 65 to 80.
Yes.
As Lula does. Sailor dies at 65. But, I mean, the thing is, it's all very contemporary. It's all right now. Yeah. I'm not writing in the year 2034. So that's a very important factor. Somebody asked me that question once, who noticed, in an interview. And I said, well, how can I write about 2035? We're not in 2035. I'm not a science fiction writer, and I don't know what's going to be going on then. I don't, you know, so I have to place them in the time that I know. So there is this device of compression of time. To address your question more precisely, the only real difference in time that takes place is between the sixth novel and the seventh. Bad Day for the Leopard Man, really. And then, which I thought was the end of the series. And then 15 years later, I came to write The Imagination of the Heart, which was published in hardcover last year, and gave Lula a chance to speak at the age of 80, and yeah. She writes her own book.
Yeah. Well, that also makes me wonder, because by the sixth chapter of that novel...
Because it's really... Let me just interrupt to say that Sailor and Lula, why I chose to call this omnibus Sailor and Lula, The Complete Novels, is because, first of all, that's the title in many countries. Like in France, it's Sailor et Lula, just as the film was. And in Spain, it's Sailor y Lula, you know, like that. Because Wild at Heart, which was the first novel, originally was too difficult to translate correctly, really to get this, capture the same feeling. So my suggestion was to call it Sailor and Lula,
yeah,
which is why they called the film Wild at Heart that. And by then the book was a bestseller in France anyway. But it's really one novel.
Yeah. But in terms of issues of translation, which you bring up here, I'm curious if you consulted with translators on the vernacular in any capacity, or how...
Only in French.
Only in French.
Because I can't really read properly in any other language. The French, you know, got it mostly right. After the first book, the translation by Jean-Paul Gratias is exemplary. He translated all six of those and has been lobbying hard to have Wild at Heart retranslated there. It's okay, but it's not as good as the last six.
And going back to the last novel, we were talking about how Lula's voice forms a sizable chunk of that book, and yet by the sixth chapter, we get to a third-person narrative device similar to the other books, and I'm
correct.
Curious as to whether there was any thought in your mind to writing the entire book from Lula's particular vernacular, or whether this just proved to be impossible to keep the plot advancing as it did.
Nothing proved impossible, it's just how, you know, it occurred to me. I mean, Lula begins, I wanted Lula's voice more than anything. Lula's the favorite of all of my female characters that I've ever created. And I wanted her voice, I wanted it uninterrupted and pure. And she has, you know, many soliloquies, if you will, within the other novels, but this was just her. And then when she and her friend Beanie decide to take this last road trip from North Carolina to New Orleans, you know, then it just slides very naturally into the same construction as I'd had through the previous six books. You know, now it's, but then it's interlaced with her journal entries, with her write, you know, keeping a journal with her diary, if you will, that kind of thing. And you see the grammar changes, the construction. I mean, her sentences are and spelling are her own.
Yeah, but in responding to how New Orleans has changed, you take a series of books or one novel that has essentially, to my mind anyway, been a response to the latter 50 years of the 20th century, and you've then created an anchor point in the 21st century. I'm curious why you really wanted to dwell a little bit more specific on more current developments in that latter book. Was it in relation to just focusing more tightly on Lula's vernacular that created an additional, an augmented concentration?
That's a good question, but there's more than one thing, and one of the main points was Katrina.
Yeah.
I kept a place in New Orleans between 1990 and 1998. I'd spent quite a bit of time there as a child, and then later as an adult, and I was very affected, as was everybody there, obviously, to make an understatement, by the flood, by what happened. And so I really wanted to incorporate that into the book and to talk about that, to discuss the situation, and that's what I did. So, and it was a natural thing too, because I set it up so that Lula and Sailor's son, Pace, was working in New Orleans and, you know, on the reconstruction, and he, you know, he's of course an adult. And Lula hadn't been back in 30 years.
Yeah.
Wait, 30 years? No, I'm sorry, 25 years. So, 25 years? 15 years. I can't keep up with myself. 15? Yeah, 15 years. And so that was kind of a natural, and also the fact that her best friend of most of her adult life, Beanie, was from Louisiana as well. And I don't know, I guess it's Lula's voice just kept, it was insistent. It just kept poking at me. I wasn't finished with her yet.
It leads me to also ask you about the shortness of the chapters. And the Lula chapters in that book are extremely, it's like maybe 500 words tops. So I'm wondering just...
Well, those are her journal entries.
Yeah,
so that's how she wrote in sort of a staccato fashion.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if each of these chapters was written in one sitting, whether you approach it like a poem in some sense, or...
You could say that.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily write them just one at a time, you know, one a day or anything like that. I don't think like that. I mean, if it's there, I'll write it. If it's not, I won't. I don't work every day. I mean, the thing is that when it's there to be written, and I don't mean to make this sound like I'm Mr. Natural taking, you know, just the sign from the stars that this is it, I'm not insistent. I don't force the issue. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I'm curious how much rumination goes into thinking about a chapter before you set it down, or whether it needs to be put down with this sense of improvisation or this sense of almost interstitial creation that you're describing.
Well, given what I just said, basically what happens is when I start rolling, it's all there. I mean, it really is just there. I just have to write it down. I know this sounds sometimes to people unbelievable or... But it isn't at all. I mean, now I'm inhabiting her mind and her voice, and I have to speak for her, and I try to be as true to that voice and to her thought process as it's possible to be.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about the news reports that filter throughout all the books. Often it comes from a newspaper, it comes from a radio transmission. At one point in Sultans of Africa, you have Sailor on hold on the phone, and then he gets this bizarre report about wild turkey. I'm curious about why these interventions from the outside world consistently pop up into the book. It's almost as if these characters are forced to confront some representation of reality as they're also
attempting. Don't forget what the whole novels are centered by, which is really that there's all this, you know, shit coming down all around everybody all the time, and it's a love story. At the center of all this is a true love story between Sailor and Lula. And somehow, despite all of this crap that rains down around and on them, they maintain their love. And you know, they try and you know, exist and have their life and, you know, deal with each other despite all of the distractions, all of the insanity. And it allows me to explore my own bête noire, like, you know, fundamentalist religion, racism, all of that sort of thing. And while not, you know, sending a message necessarily, these are all things that are going on. So whatever it happens to be, it's in the news. It also, it dates and times the stories themselves. So we know where we're at when this is happening. And people are affected by current events.
Yeah.
And it affects Sailor and Lula no less.
But it also brings to mind the scenario of Johnny Farragut, who I always found to be quite an intriguing character. Here he is, this aspiring amateur writer.
Yeah.
He's influenced heavily by Outer Limits or Twilight Zone episodes, or so he thinks, because when we actually read his stories, it's actually pretty much what he's already just experienced, which is rather interesting. If he's trying to create a fictional representation of how he lives, it's nowhere nearly as outre as he thinks. And so I'm curious about, going back to this issue of reality, that's why I bring up the news stories as well, why all of these characters in some sense have to grapple with this disparity.
Well, I mean, all of our, when I write, my life experience goes into these books as well. My own observations, obviously. My own experiences, you know, what I've gone through, what people in my family go through, what my friends go through. I mean, you know, that's all. And that's the same thing that Johnny Farragut is doing. And so sometimes when you have a basis in reality like that, there's more authenticity in the text, in the story that you're writing. And then you can just go from there, and that's what fiction's all about. It means you made it up. Yeah. But you incorporate, you know, everyday events and your own life clearly.
Yeah.
It's all fodder, you know, for the mill.
But to what sense can these characters be said to pass the time? I mean, in Wild at Heart, you have the moment between Buddy and Sparky where they're making up a top 10 list of songs, and the only explanation given is that here they are trying to pass the time, and that chapter is the meaning of life. So there's a suggestion here that there's some cultural relationship with which to, A, live life or pass the time, that this is now the only option almost granted to these characters in this, not exactly American wasteland, but certainly something that is very violent.
Well, Sparky and Buddy were stranded in West Texas.
Yeah.
And so you're exactly right. I mean, they are, like, passing the time in a sense. But it also allows us to find out about them and, you know, what means something to them, and they're trying to amuse themselves, and so what is the meaning of life? You tell me, Ed.
It's living.
You know, it's ongoing.
Yeah.
And it's organic, and that's really what I meant to portray or convey, you know, in that time and place.
I'm curious why you offered the reader the nugget of explaining why Sailor called Lula Peanut. It's almost that when we get that particular peanut, so to speak, then all of a sudden the mystery of that term of affection is either nullified, or we can ignore it and just continue to just find ourselves very intoxicated by the notion of calling someone peanut. Why offer that explanation?
Well, at first she doesn't, you know, she takes exception to it, you know, but then she embraces it. But it's an endearment. In fact, it's funny because in French, it doesn't really work the same way. And so my translator, at that time, Richard Matas, he used the word crevette, which is a little shrimp, you know, like that. And that was really perfect. It worked. So in each different country, they have, like, sometimes they'll change that, you know. But it's just a term of endearment. I mean, I think that, you know, I've always been prone to giving people nicknames or my own private names for them.
Yeah.
And this is just more of the same.
I wanted to also go back to the meaning of life chapter in Wild at Heart. There are a number of strange maxims that are often offered, you know, finding out the meaning of life and all is fine far as it goes, but dead's dead, you know what I mean? At the end of Wild at Heart, there ain't no need to make life tougher than it needs to be. It's almost as if you're suggesting that there is no real homily that could truly capture what it is to live, and yet these characters are fond of often gushing these little little pithy little.
But this is stuff. The way people speak in the South.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to understand that in one sense, this is, it might be considered a regional novel, in a sense, with universal truths, if I may.
Yeah.
And that's really all that is. This is the way people speak, and people I've grown up with, lived among. This is the way people speak. So I'm just reflecting, the naturalisms, if you will, of the characters.
You don't actually attempt to have a piece of dialogue work on numerous levels. You don't really think about laying down any metaphors or anything like that. That really it's just a case of natural vernacular representation.
At the risk of sounding disingenuous, I have to say, Ed, that I'm not the most analytical person on the planet, so that I really feel as if these characters are given life, within my head, and that's how the whole thing started in the first place. I woke up one day and I heard this conversation going on between Sailor and Lula.
Yeah.
And I got up and I started writing it down, and they were in this motel room by the Cape Fear River in North Carolina, and then I just had to get them out of that room. And, went on from there. So, as somebody wrote once about the series, said, if a writer is lucky, these kinds of characters come along once in a lifetime. Once in a writer's lifetime. And I believe that's true with Sailor and Lula. There's no question about it. Lula being really the dearest to me.
Yeah.
Not that there aren't others who are dear to me, but this is really true. It's like David Lynch always said. He said, "I saw Sailor and Lula, basically adrift in this wild world, and I wanted to go on the adventure with them." It's kind of like Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah.
And Jim going down the river on the raft.
Why do these characters? Why do you believe that they kept coming back and haunting you? Their voices in your head. You've lived with them for a number of years. Was it simply the fact that often you would end one of these installments on a particular cliffhanger or unresolved question, or did what do you believe provoked? I suppose the voices coming back to you.
I had written, Landscape with Traveler and Portra Peak novels before Wild at Heart. But beginning with Wild at Heart, it's the first time that I wrote out of the southern side of myself, because I grew up equally in the Deep South and in the North, in Chicago. My recent books have been based mainly in Chicago. But it gave me a kind of a freedom to explore, in a sense, that I really had not felt before. I was looking for a kind of purchase, I guess, rather than just write each novel to take on a subject or this and that. I wanted to explore people's lives who I thought were interesting, and if not unique, and who had not been given a voice particularly before. I think that's really the key. The key was to allow people to talk and think and be exposed in a way that I didn't think had ever happened before. And, of course there were examples. Like, I'd written several of these novels before. A friend of mine said, "Did you ever read Flannery O'Connor? I think you and she are cousins." Well, being largely an autodidact and self-educated, no, that was a lacuna. I'd missed Flannery O'Connor somewhere along the line there. And then I went and read Flannery O'Connor, and I laughed. And, the thing is that there was a lot in common. She saw things similarly, and that same mordant sense of humor existed. She got it.
Yeah.
And I felt I was too, but I thought that I was bringing it into a more, setting it on a more contemporary stage.
Well, you dedicated this omnibus to Wilford. I'm curious if...
No, Wild at Heart was dedicated
Wilford. Got it. Well, what about his influence? He's operating in a similar mode, starting with Miami Blues and onward.
No, but I was thinking of Charlie's. Charlie was a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of his books. Well, I was thinking of him, basically, who he was as a person, and certain things that he had said to me. And he had a lot of aspects to his life. I mean, certainly writing was one of them.
Yeah.
He was a lifelong military man, basically. He had two pensions, one from the Army, one from the Air Force. He had trained horses. He had done, you know, all these different things. In any case. But in books like The Burnt Orange Heresy, for example, some earlier works of his, that's a kind of crime thriller, but the first 40 pages is an exegesis on modern art.
Yeah.
So the thing is that what he showed me was that you could put anything in here. I mean, you know, as long as it was firmly grounded, as long as you knew where you were going with it, and you were true to the characters, and you gave enough information in this way. So, you know, he inspired me in a certain way, and that's why I gave him Wild at Heart, you know. And then I was also, you know, I got a kick out of that line that Clifford Odets wrote, that Tuesday Weld spoke in the movie Wild in the Country, which I use as an epigraph. You know, you need a man to go to hell with.
Yeah.
Well, who was Sailor? Sailor was a guy who was well-intentioned and all that, but he was a lunkhead. He kept making mistakes over and over. He wound up in jail on a couple of occasions. He killed a man on one occasion. I mean, all of this. And Lula, even though she was younger, she was the smart one. She was the one who grounded him. And I liked this idea. And it's been true in my own life that, for the most part, I mean, certain women that I know and that I've met have been the smartest people, you know, really the ones making the best decisions.
One thing that interests me in this collection, in this large novel, if you will, is the fact that we start off by having a lot of scenes set in cars. Basically, we're dealing with cars, motel rooms, a rootless existence. And then as we get closer near the end, we start seeing a lot of car crashes. I mean, Consuela opens up with that wonderful line about observing the car crash.
The train wreck.
Yeah, the train wreck. I'm sorry. Yeah, exactly. And so I'm interested in this. It's almost as if as Sailor has become more domesticated and finally admitted that he needs to be there for Lula, suddenly crashes come up more and more frequently. I'm wondering if you could remark on this.
I didn't notice.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is that, yes, it begins in a picaresque way.
Yeah.
That's how the novels begin. But then, you know, Sailor and Lula settle down. They're living in New Orleans for 30 years. I mean, you know, he's in a business, and, you know, the Gator Gone, you know, Alligator and Crocodile Repellent Company. And, you know, but they have a son who goes off with the Radler brothers, and he has his adventures, and, you know, they encounter different characters, like you mentioned, like in Suela Why Not and Mississippi, and, you know, all of this kind of thing. And the automobile, anyway, I mean, you know, this is America, honey.
Yeah.
As I used to say to an old girlfriend of mine all the time, who was from Italy, and, you know, was always remarking upon, I mean, she was always amazed by things that were going on around her, and sometimes I had no sufficient explanation. And I would just say, it's America, honey. I always meant to write a book called It's America, Honey, but probably now I would get, you know, like castigated for using the word honey or something.
Surprised it wasn't a piece
I'm
of dialogue. I
probably do it anyway. Well, I was saving it.
Yeah.
I was saving it for the book. A nonfiction book, by the way. Anyway, who knows? But, you know, people, especially, look, you're from California. I've lived in California for the better part of my life. And, you know, I used to be fond of taking long automobile trips. So the automobile's our way of life, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not everybody lives in Manhattan and takes the subway.
Yeah.
You know, for better or worse, we became dependent on automobiles. And this is how people get around. And there's vast distances. How do you get from one place to the other? You know, and it's that method of escape, and I think escape is certainly a leitmotif all through the Sailor and Lula novels.
Yeah. I wanted to also touch upon Perdido Durango and the difference between Duane and Estelle and Sailor and Lula. You have Perdita and Romeo essentially rape them and take their virginity, and but the thing is that Duane...
Their innocence.
Yes, their innocence. But what is interesting is that when you have the Bad Road chapter in Perdita Durango, you describe Estelle's memory of her own mother, but it's centered on her father, this guy who's essentially a guy who smokes larks, drives a 7-Up truck, and has even taken his name after the famous singer. It's almost as if they're victims to some degree of a consumerist culture, or that this the fact that that's the only memory, it's almost as if that creates this relationship between this more passive victimization. And I'm wondering to what extent you thought you contrived with Dwayne and Estelle, while also keeping Sailor and Lula in the back of your mind, because Sailor and Lula, of course, are not really prominent characters in that particular book.
Well, the point is, don't be a victim.
Yeah.
I mean, that's I think I have another chapter somewhere that's called Victims. But that's always been another kind of thing that I could never abide. People who see themselves as victims, you know, with a capital V.
Yeah.
And I just don't like to be around people like this.
Yeah.
People who complain all the time or are a victim, and they feel that they're a victim of, you know, their environment, their parents, their husband, their wife, their boyfriend, their girlfriend, God, whatever it is that they want to call it. It's convenient, isn't it? It's an easy way out.
Yeah.
And in the case of the kids in Perdita Durango, I mean, they were just kids. They were like dumb college kids, you know, and here they were kidnapped for the purpose of human sacrifice.
Yeah.
I mean, what a terrible thing.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, Romeo and Perdita are certainly colorful characters, but malevolent ones. So that they're the natural contrast to Sailor and Lula.
Yeah. But these two college kids, did you really feel a good deal of fury or hatred towards them? Or?
No.
Huh.
No, I don't feel any fury or hatred toward any of these characters. I mean, in one sense, yes. I mean, we're all subject to all of the things that have come before, to our upbringing, to, you know, and to all these things that I mentioned. The key is, how do you deal with them? How do you assert yourself? How do you retain some semblance of control over your own life? Control has always been a big issue with me. I'm not an easily controlled person in a way. I'm very faithful, I'm very loyal, and all of those things. But it has to be on my own terms, in the sense that if somebody is there purposefully and clearly and obviously attempting to manipulate me, that's over. There's no chance of my having any sort of friendship or relationship with that person. And that's what Perdita Durango is mainly about. Now, nobody had a worse childhood than Perdita Durango.
Yeah.
She's definitely, if anybody could be called a victimized person, and that it laid out her life for her, you know, and what is she trying to do? She's trying to control her own existence. She's fighting for her life. And that's the theme that I always felt with Perdita. I love Perdita. I mean, she's crazy.
Yes.
And she's dangerous. But I love her.
These issues of control are interesting because here you have worked in Hollywood, in which the writer is always considered last, for the most part. I know that you appeared on a panel recently in which you had no problem with your books being adapted and being transformed to something completely different. But there is, in dealing with Hollywood, a sense of capitulating control. And I'm curious as to how you find control in a situation where you know the writer's always going to get screwed.
Well, as my friend Richard Price has mentioned before and said the other night, you know, he says, I'm in it only for the money.
Yeah.
You know, I have my books. And one thing that I said was, after the film Wild at Heart came out, people said to me, well, what do you think about what David Lynch did to your book? I said, I wasn't aware he did anything to my book.
Yeah.
I knew what they were asking. But the book is still there. Read the book. He didn't change a sentence. He didn't change a period or a comma. The book is there. The movie may endure. The book may or may not endure, whatever it happens to be. But, you know, it's still there. It's inviolable. The movie is another animal. It's a different form. It's a different art form. You have other opportunities with movies. And I love the movies. And I learned a lot about how to write from the movies when I was a child, just watching all-night movies all the time, you know, that sort of thing. And I learned how to tell a story and how to build character development and all of that kind of thing. That doesn't mean that I sat down to write movies. I did not. And when I have the opportunity or choose the opportunity to write a screenplay, you know, really the writer only has one shot at it. It's that first draft. So when you write that first draft, you have to see that movie the way you want it to be seen. And so there are no excuses. Of course, there's more or less manipulation. I mean, sometimes I work better in Europe because they change fewer things. But as in the case of Lost Highway, which David Lynch and I wrote together, everything that's in that movie is written.
Yeah.
It's all there. Yeah. Nothing was changed. Yeah. I mean, so what could be better than that?
So the degree of participation you have in this, understanding the nature of the medium, is really the way to, I suppose, offset any control situations that might cause you some discomfort.
Well, if you're working with a studio and they have certain ideas and they bring in, you know, other writers and all that kind of thing, and I've had this experience too, then it's just out of your hands. Don't worry about it anymore. You know, if it's based on a novel of yours, you might have some concern, and you can just look at it as any other spectator might, any other viewer, and say, yeah, well, that's nice they kept that, and it's too bad they lost that, and she doesn't look anything, you know, like Lola, or he doesn't look anything like Billy, or, you know, that was in my mind. But that was okay. I mean, who could have been better than Laura Dern was fantastic as Lula in the film Wild at Heart, but yet my character has black hair and gray eyes. Laura Dern is blonde and blue-eyed. So, but she was perfect. I mean, she, you know, the thing is, even with Lynch with Wild at Heart, he filmed everything in that novel.
Yeah.
It was almost 4 hours long.
Yeah.
You know, but he had his perspective on it, and he wanted to make it modern. That's okay. It wasn't boring.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask, because you have, of course, Phil Real in Bad Day for the Leopard Man.
Yes.
And so the interesting thing is, here is this disgraced director who finds a home within the uncompromising medium of fiction. I'm wondering as to how this voice came about and why suddenly you felt interested in writing about a director who faces a rather interesting end as well.
Well, because actually Phil Real's, like, feel real, you know.
Yes.
But Philip Real's history is really quite a common one. I mean, there have been many directors, especially American directors, who kind of bottomed out in Hollywood after maybe having one or two successes or being, you know, a little too difficult for the studios to handle, who go to Europe and then do other things and all that. But yet, you know, they're vocation is to be a director, a film director, so you want to keep making films and all that. And so I've known several people like this, and that's what I really based it on.
Would you identify yourself first and foremost as a writer? You mean you've dabbled in journalism, not dabbled, but you've written journalism, poems, screenplays, and the like. I mean, would fiction be
it all entails writing?
Yeah.
So I describe myself as a writer. I mean, it's great to be able to, I mean, I guess I'm primarily a fiction writer. Then I'm a screenwriter, but I've written opera libretti, essays, biography, you know, plays. The thing of songs, the thing about it is that it's wonderful to be able to have these different forms to choose among. Because, you know, ideas or things come to you in certain ways, and now, you know, I'm able to say, oh, I think this will work better as a play, or this will work better as a poem, or this. I started as a poet. I started as a musician, actually, and the poetry came from the song lyrics. So, you know, it's like building that foundation and learning how to, really writing poetry and studying in that way taught me how to write a sentence properly. But I have been writing these same stories since the age of 11. So I had a beginning in that way. So what am I? I mean, it's not like a writer with a capital R.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, who I am, but I, you know, I do lots of things.
Do the differing forms allow you to avoid the prospect of creative exhaustion in the sense that you can approach some idea or some voice in your head in a manner totally differently in one medium that you'll have advantages and disadvantages in one medium over another. This keeps you, I suppose, not necessarily repeating yourself.
But it depends, yes, and it also depends on the subject. That's what I meant before by saying choosing the correct form. And sometimes I don't choose correctly. You know, and when, then I'll look
when
at
when have
it
you not chosen correctly?
Well, I'll think that something, oh, this is better as a screenplay, say. You know, I can see this. I say, no. You know, I get into it and I say, I've got to go. No, this is a novel.
Yeah.
This just happened to me recently. That's the first time that ever happened to me. Then I had an idea for a story, and just a short story, because I came late to writing short stories. The short stories are always included within the fabric of the novels. You know, they were like chapters in the novels. But then I realized, no, this is a much longer piece. This has to be something else. And so it grew up. It grew up in my head. But I really don't plan this. I mean, I have to say, I don't plan any of this. Now, if, for instance, I just wrote the libretto for an opera in Melville, for Olga Neuwirth, who's a great composer, Viennese composer. Olga actually wrote the opera based on Lost Highway, based on Lynch's and my screenplay. And Elfriede Jelinek, you know, who won the Nobel Prize, wrote that libretto. But, you know, she came to me and she said, I want you to write this libretto. So there are certain rules. You know, no matter what the composer says, I had written one before for Toru Takemitsu, the Japanese composer, and, you know, for his opera. But the thing was, they say, oh, there's no rules. I don't want you to read other libretti. I don't want you to put all this stuff in, you know, whatever you want. But, of course, you know, then they'll say, where's the beautiful duet? Where's this? Where's, you know, so I have to make certain, they're not concessions. I just have to understand this is the rules of the game.
Yeah.
The same thing with the screenplay. There are certain things that it's better not to do.
Yeah.
There are certain things that you probably shouldn't do. You probably shouldn't have an interior monologue in here. But I got news for you. If it occurs to me that it's going to work in this context, I'll do that.
Yeah. What creative possibilities do you find within rules or limitations?
What I was saying before was I started writing something as a story and I realized, no, this will work better, I think, theatrically.
Yeah.
So I made it into a play. But let's say I write a poem.
Yeah.
And that's just that kind of, for me, a sort of a flash of inspiration and like that. But then the emotion or the inspiration for that poem lingers. Now the poem exists, but then I realize, no, there's more to this, you know? And that's wonderful, because now I have it as a poem, and then perhaps I can extend it into a novel, or to whatever it happens. I mean, it really happens, it really works that way. I'm very fortunate, you know? And, you know, basically, I don't write what I don't want to.
Well, Barry, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Very much my pleasure.